Welcome to the Philacrosophy Podcast, where host and lacrosse expert Jamie Monroe will do what he does best, talk about lacrosse. Each episode will provide listeners with education, insights, stories, and lessons about the lacrosse world. We will discuss current events, coaching, philosophies, and college lacrosse recruiting. Now let's get started with your host, Jamie Monroe.
How's it going, everybody? Happy New Year and welcome back to the Philacrosophy Podcast. Fired up to have my boy Lars Tiffany on the New Year's show. It seems like every year, Lars, you come on to do a podcast with me around New Year's, and it's always great to catch up and talk lacrosse with you, man.
It is always great. I think I should get a t-shirt. Is this like my 10th time or 20th time? It should be a t-shirt you should send me.
I'm going to send you one. We'll send you one with, and hopefully we'll send each other away from this podcast with a few good little nuggets.
Yes. I got my notepad ready. I'm ready to write down some stuff here.
But I'm going to start this conversation with, all right, what's new? What do you got?
Kevin Cassis, that's what's new.
Yes.
Really new offensive coordinator, and 9 years, very, very fortunate to have Sean Kerwin guiding our offense, getting us to play at the frenetic, frenzied pace that we unleashed in Providence, Rhode Island, and then brought down here to Charlottesville. But now you got Kevin Cassis, who also wants to play with tempo. He's a great tactician. He's an incredible developer of talent, of individual development. And he's really, really excited about being a coordinator again. You know, when you're a head coach, there's a lot of positives that come to a head coach. You know, it starts with, obviously you get to be the head guy. You get to be the final voice. You get to make the final decisions. And the paycheck's a little different too. But it's you got a lot of other stuff you got to deal with. And Kevin's really excited about getting all in. You know, that most of his waking day is about trying to score goals and not worrying too much about curfews and business expenses and fundraising, diving into this. It's been phenomenal having Kevin here.
I love it. Well, give us a little preview, to the degree you feel comfortable, of like what this offense is going to look like.
Yeah. There's going to be a little bit more creativity, a little bit more flexibility on the flow with the players. It's certainly going to be a two-man game. Every offensive coach nowadays is putting in that because of the advantages of it. But you're going to see the players have more options than we've been in the past. And so I definitely see us being less predictable. And so a little bit more trusting and collaborative between Kevin and the players. I think in the past, we've been really successful with dodging from behind the goal and some things. And Kevin's going to maintain some of that. Some of the things will be very similar to what Sean Kerwin did, especially behind the goal. But in terms of the high wing dodge and being able to do take the alley sweep and the off-ball motions, I'm thinking it's going to be less predictable and more difficult for a defense to know exactly what the second and third options are.
Why would you say it's going to be less predictable? What's different about it? Just more options, less structure or something?
It's there's more options. There's somewhat of a structure there, but there's just more options. And again, it doesn't mean this is the better way.
Right. No. Yeah. Just different.
The way Coach Kerwin did it. Right. You know, Coach Kerwin, he would watch an opposing defense, and after the first quarter, he'd be like, okay, I got it. I need you to stand 2 yards further to your right. I need you to cut a half a second later. Bang, open, dunk. It was like magic. That guy was like, and so he was an incredible chess player. What we're seeing now is it's given the players now with Kevin's regime, they've got more choices on the multiple choice test. And so it just makes it less predictable.
I love it. Well, you're kind of like that defensively too, in the sense that like, once you kind of figure out what they're doing, you can make the adjustments you need to do. But when you're going up against an offense, you know, that doesn't give you the luxury of knowing what they're doing, it's a lot harder.
It is. And And as a defensive coach, I've become more collaborative as I've gotten older to ensure that I'm listening to the defense and giving, putting them in schemes that it gives them more opportunities to make decisions on the fly. When I was a younger coach, I wanted a puppeteer from the sideline, and some days it worked great. And, you know, we become naive and you think back on a season about those days and you sort of ignore the days where it didn't go so well, but you know, I'll get better as a coach and I'll come up with a better scheme for that. And as I've gotten older, like, why don't we decentralize command this thing, as we've learned from that military phrase, you know, they can't always call back to headquarters to know what they should, the next maneuver should be. And, so I've really enjoyed, along with Logan Greco, you know, continuing to develop a repertoire of language and decision making that gives our defense more options. We are probably more multiple than most teams that we play against on defense, and there's concern there. I get it. Some of the teams we play against have fantastic defense and they do things one way, and it's straightforward, and you get really good at it. We've tried to be a bit more multiple.
So, a lot of people have been talking about this, about the Jesse Bernhardt two-man game defense speech down at the IMLCA. Did you watch that?
I did not. I only heard bits and pieces. Give me a refresher.
Well, I didn't hear it either. I wanted to hear about it. But it basically, I think it had a lot to do with like being multiple in pick play and basically, you know, not counting on just being able to do one coverage or actually just even calling out one particular coverage pre-pick, because you just don't know how it's going to be. You don't know exactly where you're going to be on the field. And I wanted to ask you your sort of thoughts on that. You know, we've spent a lot of time talking two-man game defense over these podcasts, but, you know, you're on ball. A lot of times you want to get some ball pressure. Sometimes people say, we'll play the ball like as if there's no pick there. But then you see some people being able to like duck right underneath an easy one because it's far enough out that you can do that. Or you see somebody sort of pushing out. We talked last year about actually being deceptive that way. Almost right. like you're going under so you can go over, showing that you're going out so you can go under. And then also with your hedge guy, to be able to like show a little bit, to be able to like, you know, move the pick, to be able to slow down the dodger. A lot of people sort of hedge out while they go under, but hedging out when you go over is, you know, becomes like a double team.
Exactly.
And I'm watching a lot of PLL, and we were talking a little bit in the pre-podcast conversation, a little bit about going over picks because we were talking about Colgate's defense. And I've been watching some really cool two-man stuff in the PLL where like Jack Rowlett, like when he knows he's got a hedge right there, sometimes he'll go right over the head and just put pressure on you, go over the pick. He's not just going over the pick. He's going over the pick and get and putting you in a position where you have to tuck your stick or you're getting stripped and you might run right into somebody. And I just wanted to sort of open up the conversation to just interesting things in two-man game as it relates to variability.
Your last example there brings me back to sitting in the office in Providence, Rhode Island, when you were on your home from Denver lacrosse practice, and you would invariably call me around 7 o'clock your time. It'd be 9 o'clock my time, and I'm trying to go home. But you knew I was usually in the office.
I knew you'd be in the office till 9 o'clock.
I know, I wasn't married then. And you'd say like, hey, I got this idea. You just reminded me of that idea. Like, look, defensively, how about going over the head at the GLE when you know you've got a slide coming from the crease or cross crease right away? I mean, what's the guy got to do? He's got to tuck it. And so what you just decided to find there, you know, with Rowlett, you know, if you're going over the pick, but you know, you got a big hedge, you know, why not throw it? Cause you got essentially a double team or potential for a double team there. It's interesting.
It is.
I'm going to have to
write that one down.
About that
I'll
one down.
Send you the clip. I got a couple clips on that.
Cool. I'd like to see that, but I will admit we are multiple with the way we play picks here, to the point sometimes, Jamie, that I'm like, ooh, am I making this too complex? The base part you need to do, I think we call it the red zone. Anything 11 yards and closer to the goal, we call it red zone. We're really lucky here at UVA in terms of our practice field that we actually have an arc at 11 yards. And so on our practice field, we can define what the red zone is. And we have to protect that. So pick play outside of the red zone. For the most part, we're going underneath that pick. Just step underneath it. If he steps away from it and wants to shoot from 15 yards, fine. But anything inside of it or near the top of the red zone or edge of the red zone, we're going to play more physical and play above that pick and be more demanding there. And then with the off ball, you're right. You know, switch through double or backside double. Let it go through and then try to backside double it. So we've tried to give our guys, again, a bigger menu. And again, so I'll admit, sometimes it's like maybe it's a little too much. But again, I don't need you as the player. You don't need to be great at all of them. But as you go through this repertoire, your first year or two here, you start realizing what you're best at, you know, as the off-ball player with that hedge. Are you getting a big chip? Are you a good double-team guy? And so we do talk a lot about being, you know, various options with pick play.
How do you generally communicate it?
Off-ball guy does all the talking. On-ball guy can ignore if he wants to go above a pick. You know, we might be saying over, under for a through. You can say through, but over and under insinuates you're getting through. So over, yeah. Over, under. And that's being made by the off-ball guy. The on-ball guy can ignore it. Like I say, you know, if he's like, no, I got a good chunk here. I'm going to drive him above this pick and I want to stay above it. But essentially the off-ball guy is telling us where you are on the field and you should go under this pick as opposed to we're closer to the edge of the red zone. You should go over this pick. And then that off-ball guy can then insinuate a switch or if we want to do a double team. And a lot of it is through because we're trying to keep matchups and most offensive coordinators are bringing two to the ball that it wouldn't be easy to switch on. Right. And they're trying to maintain matchups in a big little scenario, or if there's a offensive midi trap down on our defensive end, of course, we're going to try to keep our matchup and get through that. So a majority of our work is on our through work. I'll tell you, Jamie, if we do 15 minutes of pre-practice before we do the dynamic warm-up and stretch and get things going. The defense is together. The offense is at one end. The goalies are another end. Face-off guys on the side. Those 15 minutes with the defense, I'd be maybe a couple times a month. There's no pick play during that 15 minutes of slow, just defense, talking through, walking through, going through picks. But just about every day, the defensive pre-practice, we're doing pick play. And if you looked at, you know, one of my defenses 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, they might've done it twice a month, right?
Yeah. It's happening a lot. On those sort of pre-practice, early practice stuff, I've watched you there and we've chatted a little bit about it. How has it evolved? Cause you just sort of said, walk through, jog through, kind of half speed. How have you evolved it to create variability and to create reads rather than repping something that they don't have to make a decision on, or has it not?
Yeah, I will say in the pre-practice, it's mostly reps. The reads don't happen until we get with the offense.
Now, why is that? Why not create reads in a half to three quarter speed situation? Why not create reads?
Right. Probably to get as many reps as possible to reinforce it. But I'm not going to sit here and defend my stance too much because I do, you know, I mean, you're just giving me another idea. Can I create more reads in pre-practice drills as opposed to, all right, we're going to do all these and these are all outside the red zone. Okay, now let's get everybody down here. Now we're going to be inside the red zone on the low wing. And this is how we play it. And save the reading for when we're doing a 2v2 with the offense when they come down here after the dynamic warm-up. So it's a good thought. It's a good challenge for me to put some more thought into some drills where there's more decision-making as opposed to repping.
Yeah. I mean, I can see how you could rep a pick situation. Although there will be an option to, you know, the tricky part of pick play isn't getting under or getting over. It's when they're right on that borderline.
Mm-hmm.
The arc.
Yep, exactly.
Right within a yard or two of that. Right within, you know, goal line. You're at goal line, but you're not that close to the crease, but you're kind of close to the crease. You know, do we jump this or do we not? You know what I mean? That is where, you know, where there becomes some decisions in for sure in two-man game. And there might be some decisions based on the picker's man, based on what, you know, you said, hey, our on-ball guy, our picker doesn't talk about our on-ball guy doesn't have to do it. And that's a read. And there might be a read as far as the hedge and get back. Cause like a guy might go over a pick and successfully get over it, especially with a little help from the hedge.
Right.
Or he might not get back and it might be time to like, you know, rip the guy and step up. And then, you know, you throw a third, you know, you throw somebody else now on the crease. And now they've got a decision as to whether I have to spike off this thing and make a play. But the only reason why I'm saying is I just feel like that's one of the things I learned. I actually learned a lot about that from Jerry Byrne. He really has been masterful, in my opinion, over the years at creating situations with reads and slide decisions, almost where the offense is working together with the defense to give a look. So like, you know, like, hey, you know, like if you want to work on slide decisions, you know, and a dodge or an alley dodge, let's say with a redodge and a slider and a second slide, and you want to get a redodge or you want to get a, you need to work together. You can't have the defender on ball play live defense against someone who's going half speed when you want to try to get a look of a hedge, a bounce out, you know.
Sure.
Get back and then redodge and go late, you know, and so to be able to get that. But I think what that does also is it creates unbelievable IQ for the players because they're working together to create the look that you need, that you know you're going to see, that you want to see, and then you know they completely understand that look, whatever look that is, and there's a million of them.
Sure. Now it makes sense to if we're doing our typical 3v3 drill where, you know, pass pick down, pass, pick towards. We could do that right at the edge of the red zone. We could do that right around 12 yards, 13 yards, or at least simulate that with where we put the imaginary goal because we're in the middle of the field oftentimes. And a good offense, just as you were sort of insinuating, will find where is those gray areas for that zone defense? What is the gray area for their pick play? Mm. You know, let's see if we can get right in that in between where we make them uncomfortable. So I could certainly see putting it there, but yeah, I'll admit the pre-practice for me is less reading and it's more nailing down the communication, the stance, how we approach, our stance off ball. We do have some decision making in terms of our slide schemes.
Yeah,
we do some five and a die work, and that is a little bit more decision making to rep our slides. But yeah, there's certainly some opportunities there to make some more reads. But
it's like they're not mutually exclusive. Like, why wouldn't you doing them? Man, you're going to do everything you were doing anyway.
Yeah, but it's always good to get these extra reps, you know. And I think, as you know, the small ball is a great place. You know, having listened to some of your podcasts in the past, especially when you had the European basketball coach, and you know, just creating the small ball, creating a scenario for them to go and give them only maybe one or two limitations. Like, okay, it has to start with a pick on ball. Mm-hmm. You know, or pick off ball and then go. And so I know we've done some of that too with our small ball, our 3v3, and encourage like, hey, you have to set picks so we can get more of those reads off ball. But yeah, most of our reading has probably been, all right, the dynamic warmup's done, the stick work's done, bam, all right, three stations, 2v2s on the low wing dodge over there, bam, all right. And I spent a lot of my time at that end as opposed to the shooting end or the ground ball part.
Yeah. One of the things you bring up, Alex Sarama, is the basketball coach you're talking
about.
Oh, yeah. One of the topics that I've been thinking a lot about, I've used the word a few times on this podcast, is variability. You know, I feel like variability is almost something that we all know is important in our hearts because we know the game is so variable and we know our opponents are so variable and the matchups are so variable. There's like nothing that works the same way twice, even though conceptually they can. But a lot of times it's like so much more comfortable to get a drill that you really like. It's like, I really like this drill. I want to do this. I like to do this drill. I've done that. I'm sure we've all done that. And I think one of the things that I've learned so much in the last 3 to 6 months is just how important it is to tweak those drills that we like so much and make them different. Make them different, like, almost every day. Because there might be nothing more impactful than having adaptive players. The more adaptive they are, the better you're going to fare in a real game than less adaptive. And the more different looks, the more different things you do, the more different constraints you use, the more coverages you use, the more actions you use, the more, you know, constraints, whether it be goal size or shot clock or space, numbers, you know, virtually everything, and just trying to change things up. Not just to change things up, because if you're really good with the constraints-led approach, you're intentionally changing things to try and get some kind of different emergence of a, you know, new skill or a new something. And sometimes it's trial and error, of course, you know, like you can try something you've never tried before and see what happens. But I just was curious what your thoughts were on that concept, because it's been something I've been thinking a lot about. I think it's like maybe one of the most important things coaches should really wrestle with.
Right. And I'm probably on both sides of this. I'm guilty of leaning on some drills that I've probably been doing since, you know, maybe the Stony Brook days. You know, certain drills, just love them. And it's just, we're not changing this one. And then getting into routine, like, wow, I really like that drill. But I do, there are some other things that we have evolved. You can see the evolution from how it starts as a general drill, then adding another offense player, adding another defensive player, getting a fake slide in there, then the ball's moved. And sometimes to the point where I can't remember what the drill looked like in its original format. And so it's, that's been fun to do. And I'm certainly guilty, or, you know, pleased to be charged guilty, where we do go out there, especially because once we're done with our dynamic warmup and stick work, we go into three stations, you know, split up the team in thirds almost every practice. And that's where I kind of do some experimenting. Like, you know, I really want to work on a crease slide here, but, you know, with a backside hunt cut. All right, let's try this. It's only a 4-minute drill for that group, you know, and two other groups are coming through. And a lot of times I never see that drill again, but then sometimes you find magic, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's where the best part of the Dr. Frankenstein experimentation probably happens.
Yeah. Well, I think there's so many ways to create variability that don't actually change the drill that much, but give you a different look. So I'll give you an example. Do you do 4-on-4s?
Yes.
Like a Y drill of some kind or something like that.
We got the Y, we got the square. Yeah, we got a few of those.
So a really cool way to create variability within that would be to, like, have different starts. I'm messing around a lot with different starts to basically create advantages for the offense generally. So the defense has to deal with that. But also so that the offense has to learn how to capitalize on an advantage. I feel like one of the hardest things to do is not just create the advantage, but to capitalize on it. Because I feel like sometimes people, when they beat their man by so much that they're, like, literally just running into a slide. And the more predictable that is, the easier it is for defense, right? And so how do you, like, so, you know, on Zoom calls with athletes, I'm for years I've been, like, trying to figure out how to explain deception and how to, like, control sliders and how to not let the dominoes, so to speak, fall on time. Okay. When a slide goes, it's like, you know, it's like dominoes falling. But with your defense, if your dominoes are falling on time, you're probably going to slide and recover pretty well and then be back to neutral again. Mm-hmm. But if your first slide is delayed, and then late, your second slide is going to be delayed and late. And there may not be, the dominoes may never fall, or they may fall really, really late. And I feel like, so taking any Y drill, any 4-on-4 drill, and starting to do some different starts, like maybe you, which we've all kind of done, give them a bigger shade, you know, or maybe you, you know, start them on the side or start them behind, or you say, okay, we're going to start this in a post up. The defender has to guard him as if he's on the island, but he's not. He's up at the restraining line. he's going to spin off this thing and create offense. And then with that, he's going to create, depending on how big of a step you decide to give the guy based on the constraint you use, it might give him chances to hezzy and hitch and on the run hitch and slow the whole game down for themselves, making it harder for your defense and teaching that offensive player to do something that he may not otherwise get a rep at. So there's a, there's been a lot of like, I've just been messing around with this and I love it because I want my defense to have to slide anyways, and I want my offense to learn different things. I don't need them to do the same move. It's for the same reason variability is important, you know, as I was talking about it generally as coaching. It's critical for the players to do more different stuff. If you watch, they tend to do the same things most of the time, except the very best players. They do tons of stuff. And so how do you get people doing different stuff? Because they can't. They're all capable of it. Maybe not to the same degree. Everyone's different, but they're all generally people get set in routines that they like, that they feel comfortable with. And I don't think you can argue that a routine is going to be better of doing the same things all the time is going to like teach you how to do new things.
Exactly. Yeah. I really like the idea of just listening to you talk. Cause we do, you know, we use the 4v4 like a lot of coaches do. And but you're just talking about, you know, maybe the offensive players already got a step on his guy when you're blowing the whistle.
One where I basically line up chest to chest, like arm's length, and whichever way the offensive player looks, the defensive player has to kind of jump that direction and you go.
That's funny. Like,
you know what's sick about it?
A serious fake.
but the thing is there anything more fundamental than not looking where you go?
Right.
I mean, let's think about that for real. Like when you think about the very best players, that's what they do every time. LT, look at me on the screen here. They go like this. They're like, boom.
Yeah. Right.
They look this way and go this way. What you'll notice, I was just watching film of this.
Yeah.
Just watching film of doing this drill and the guys weren't getting these big advantages. You want to know why? You know what they did? They'd look over and then they'd look back before they went. You know, watch Jeff T. He's like, boom, he just turns his head and he's gone on the head turn itself. I mean, it's crazy, but like that one has been a really, really cool way. And then, so all of a sudden you get, depending on how big the step is, you know, you let that guy kind of stay with you a little bit. You don't want to like run away from him because then you're going to run right into a slide and he's going to run right away from you and recover within, you know, when everything's on time. But when all of a sudden you, depending on how big the step is that you get.
Sure.
It will.
Sure. And you can start pinning him on your back as a Dodger.
Yeah.
Experiment with some of that as well.
Wide angle and, you know, show shot. Oh, we did a really sick one, a bait advantage. This was sick. Defense had to go for your stick.
Okay.
I got some really good clips of like Iroquois guys doing that. Like they show their sticks all the time. And then you swing at it and you're gone. But you know, one of the things that's so cool about it actually is not just to initiate the dodge, but maybe more importantly, like when you're, again, how to capitalize on an advantage. I feel like this is one of the hardest things to teach, mostly because the kids don't get that many chances to do it. Capitalizing on an advantage with a bait, what does that mean? It means that you get a step and then you like drop your hands and show shot and get them to take an angle to like chase your stick, reach, trail check, whatever, and then you're tucking it. Or maybe you're going underneath and you show your stick as if you're about to like put your stick to the inside, like a well-schooled defenseman on Lars Tiffany's team. You're waiting for that stick to show. You're patient. You're waiting for it for that trail check, but he's just baiting you because once you do it, it's fun. Exactly. And it's like I've talked about that concept a million times. But then when I started having some guys mess around with some baits, it was actually pretty insane how immediately they were doing stuff I'd never seen them do. And I'd watched them do a lot.
That's really cool to start the 1v1 of the 4v4 with a bait. And a defender has to go for it.
Even a bait cross check. That's one I was thinking about too. Me and Dave Curry, former Cavalier great, we used to talk all the time about like Olay moves where you could bait a cross check and and kind of like just like step back, you know what I mean? But it's like baiting in general, man. It's like it's the name of the game, but it's like but we've really kind of gotten away from it with like, you know, with a focus on working on specific moves rather than creating a constraint that allows you to figure out new ways of doing stuff. And that's kind of what I mean by changing stuff up. Like you could figure out a million different starts and still have you already have a 4-on-4 drill with different setups. You've done that. And there's probably, you'll come up with more. You know, maybe you have a mirror, maybe you have a circle, maybe you have, you know, spaghetti, whatever. They're all good. But then how you get into that can help develop everybody. And I think it develops both sides of the ball too. When those defensemen, you know, have to swing for a check, maybe they'll start baiting the bait.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, and they're not just going to like, let this guy bait me. They're going to like start like moving their stick around to be able to like time up that, you know, I've seen it happen because I've been watching these guys do it, but it's been pretty sick.
Yeah. That's really cool. No, it's really, I love talking to you this time of year. Cause you know, in about a week from now, we're going to be on the field and you know, 4 weeks before the first game, you gotta keep practice fresh, but more so, you know, make it variable, it's all about the player development. Get us as poised as best as we can be for that first game. And I really like this, you know, yeah, the 3v3 or 4v4 drills we do, having a lot more differentiation of what you're starting with when the man on ball and where that defender is. Put him on his back, put him on his side, baiting.
S-dodge him.
Yep. No, some really good stuff there. That's really cool.
Hey, switching gears. I'm trying to think about a little riding, clearing, small-sided games. Now, you took the old Cole Quitlam drill.
Yep.
I do appreciate you renamed it the Monroe drill, but I have to give Cole Quitlam BC and my son Colin the credit for teaching me that one. And that was kind of a cool one. It's not really small-sided. The way I sort of taught it to you, it was, and you turned it into more of a full field game. Which I love. I think it's sick. But can you think of some interesting ways to work on riding and clearing? Because where you can like not do it on a full field, you can do it with smaller numbers, and maybe you can actually work on it so it has, you know, a defense to offense and offense to defense component to it. Rather than, okay, let's work on this. And then just your starting point is either riding or clearing, because so much of the game is being able to like get up the field real quick, or to be able to like immediately get into a ride and to be able to like, you know, make quick decisions. Is there a way to bring the cages close to be able to simulate the various types of rides and clears and things that you want to be able to do? Maybe using space constraints so it's not too easy to run it over. Maybe you can't run it over. Maybe, I don't even know. I'm just sort of curious if you had anything in mind like that.
I don't, but, you know, because we lean heavily on the Monroe drill, and that drill has been fantastic. And just about every coach who's asked me about it, you know, comes back within the next day or two, like, oh my gosh, love that drill. And
explain it to everybody while you're sitting here. Why don't you?
Yeah. So essentially it's a 10v10. The key here, when a team is trying to clear the ball, there's nobody can run over the midfield line. That is the one rule that breaks the rules of lacrosse. You know, we can always have people run over the midfield line, the midfielders or a defender if he stays back. If you take away that ability for anybody to run over the midline, you all of a sudden have this Coquitlam drill that becomes like the greatest pressure riding, pressure clearing drill, you know, that I've ever seen. So it's 5v5 at each end, counting the goalie. Give the offense the ball. They're coming in 5v4, trying to score on the goalie. We do a 10-second shot clock for everything. So 10-second shot clock.
And is it 10v10 or 9v9?
It's 10v10, counting the goalies. So 5v5 at each end and counting the goalies. So offense has the ball. They're running in, trying to score in a 5v4 situation. Something happens. Goal, save, out of bounds, whatever. Defense is now clearing it. Well, it's 5v5. They've got to deal with that. They've got to deal with the fact that the riding team can play man to man and everyone's got a man. At the far end of the field, it's 5v4 plus the goalie makes it 5v5. So at the far end, the clearing team has an advantage because they've got an extra guy down there who can't run over the midline and be a resource. So you can't just give the ball to your Ryan Conrad and let him punt return. You got to pass your way out of this. You got to run by some people at sometimes, but you can't just keep running. Eventually you got to pass the ball because you can't run over the midfield line.
And what's the shot clock?
And we do a clearing clock at 10 seconds as well. We just want to keep the tempo. You know, it's a little unrealistic, but we like that tempo over this whole thing.
Yeah. But also it really puts pressure on them to clear it fast. I mean,
exactly. And it takes about the second rep for any school who starts doing this to be like, when the far end is trying to clear the ball, your end, if you're the goalie in defense, can we 10 man? Can the goalie come out? Because if we can 10 man, then nobody's open. Instead of being 5v4, can we make it 5v5 and start 10 manning? So it evolves naturally on its own without even telling the guys, or you could tell them. But, and so all of a sudden now you're trying to clear the ball. The first couple reps, there might've been somebody kind of opened the midfield line because it was 5v4. And then the other team starts the next couple reps. Now they're 10 manning or 9.5 manning, half protecting goal, half protecting the deepest guy. And it just becomes this pressure of trying to clear against this thing. And sometimes you're shooting at 70 yards. Sometimes you're throwing these bombs, which happens in real life, in a real game 4 or 5 times when you didn't find Ryan Conrad and just ran the ball out, when you had to make the pass. And as you know, if you do complete it to one of your friends on the offensive end, 10 seconds, 5v4 to the goal, bang. Then it's just going back the other way. And probably after about 2.5 minutes, we blow the whistle and stop and put in subs.
Is there a scoring system?
Yeah, we just keep in goals. Yeah, we just keep track of the goals. We don't get a point for a ride back or anything.
Are there any things that you really want to see in that you like are keys to your riding and clearing that you want to see emerge from that? Or does it all just happen? And what if it happens, what are those things?
Yeah. I mean, what's a little unrealistic is I'm thinking from the riding coach's perspective, what's unrealistic is we are all locking on a man. In real world, we have to initially drop back and take away transition from our opposing team, from the team clearing the ball, and then slowly match up to the most important guys while probably leaving somebody furthest away open. So that's where it's unrealistic. So what's important for me for this drill is at least get the drop back in. Don't just go lock a guy. Let's at least get that first 4 seconds where we can't be a 10-man riding team if they're throwing the ball over our heads, in the first 4 seconds and they're going down the front of the field with transition or at least with a slow break. Let's get that drop back and then let's identify and then we'll go match up. So that's a big priority for me.
What if you had a guy with like a red jersey on who was available in the first 4 seconds that was not available after that?
Yeah. We've done it the opposite. When a lot of teams nowadays, how they clear against a 10 man is have an attackman step over the midfield line. Once one of the D middies or LSMs goes over the midfield line, we've started introducing that. Speaking about having variability in drills, we've now had, let's say, Connor Schellenberger's on the clearing team. He's at the far end as an attackman. We'll tell him after about 4 or 5 seconds, boom, you can step over. And so that has created some realism that we like, because now it's not 5v5, it's actually 6v5 clearing. So now the riding team can't just instantly lock a guy. They've got to be careful of the roving attackman who's helping clear the ball. And so that's brought in some realism. And I'm trying to think how else we faked it. And then if Connor Schellenberger gets thrown the ball, he can go over the midline back and forth. He doesn't have to worry about onsides there.
How about putting poles on attack?
Interesting. We have encouraged offensive middies to be on the defensive side and defensive middies being the offensive side. I have not encouraged close defensemen to play attack.
I mean, it'd be probably good for some of the guys to clear against it, but it would also be pretty sick for them to be able to be a part of some transition.
No, they would love it. All right, I'm going to write that down. Monroe drill, D on attack. They will absolutely love that. That would be fun. Yeah, the Monroe drill is about 8 minutes, a couple times a week.
High intensity.
High intensity, good juice. Guys are digging it. And
I wonder if you could do that drill with youth kids back to the four on three version of it.
Oh, right. The original way you shared it with me.
Just because to keep it a little bit smaller sided and to be able to teach the same things, the pass will be a little shorter, the field will be a little smaller.
Sure. Sure.
I don't know.
I just loved it because it gives us in 8 minutes, 15 reps of where the goalie should be in the 10 man,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to setting the pieces up. All right, blow the whistle and getting like five reps in 8 minutes. it's just free flowing. And I think it's really helped with Matt Nunes and, our goalie's development of, when to get to stay in the 10 man and when to 86 this thing and fire call this back into the grease.
Switching gears. I did a webinar with you probably like 5 years ago about talking about transition offense. Do you guys still have one of the first middies or poles down back up the net?
Yes. We ideally the first middy down, let's say it's a number situation. We call fast breaker numbers. Fast breaks the traditional 4v3. Everything else is numbers, whether it's 4-on-5, if it's 5-on-3 or 5-on-4, whatever it is, numbers. In a number situation, the guy with the ball is going to do probably a pass down, pick down, or something with the attackman. Flip could do a flip, could do a fake flip, could just get it cleared through a dodge. It's the second guy down. The second guy down is he is aiming to get behind the goal, to be the backup. It liberates the three attackmen.
And I'll tell you what, I think that's the smartest thing ever. Who came out of that, Sean?
Yeah, that was from Kerwin when he came to us at Brown, brought that from Tufts.
Is like literally such a game changer, because how many times do you like either not back it up when you want to like step up to make a play, or you can't, do a wing to wing pop up with somebody else sort of inside,
Oh my God. Balestri, Blinn, and Malloy loved it. I mean, no three at Brown. They just like, we don't have to worry about backing up the cage and we could just fire away.
Unbelievable. Seriously. And then, you had all your pulls, Larkin Kemp was scoring goals because he'd be sneaking the backside and dunking.
Oh gosh, I know. I can remember a playoff game. Jake Miller, who was an exceptional long stick midi. He was stuck with behind Alec Tullett and Larkin Kemp. He sneaks the back pipe and Malloy hits him, boom, fakes, dunks it. They love it. But yeah, LSM or short stick to midi, that next guy, the first guy without the ball, he is aiming. Cut towards that crease, before you keep that head up. If you don't get thrown that ball, don't run out of the game, go behind the goal. Plus, oftentimes he's going to get matched up on by an offensive midi, somebody racing back in a hole. Now we've got that offensive midi behind the goal, and now we can go into some of our early offense, where we can set some picks and try to torture that offensive midi.
Yeah, or that offensive midi kind of is like zoning it up, and then they just get lost.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's interesting. I don't see a lot of other teams do it. Teams are playing fast for sure.
Yeah.
And doing a pass down, pick down on the wings or, and I get it too. Sometimes you've got a Darren Lowe or somebody, you're like, just get the ball to X to Darren, and we can say the same thing with Connor Schellenberger. But this, the juice that we get off the way we play offense and the D middies love it. And the LSMs love it. I will admit it. It's a little, when you're trying to convince somebody to be a short stick D middie, who's been an offensive middie their whole life. Like, hey, look the way we play. You're behind the goal. You can be dodging from behind the goal.
It's so great. Well, LT, this, as usual, was a total blast to talk lacrosse with you. You got any final thoughts as we get ready to sign off as you head into this 2024 campaign?
Yeah, it's something I'm going to really – I've been thinking about as we get into January is this deception. You've been hammering this home your whole coaching career, and I just, just thinking about how much we can do with fakes, freeze that defense. I really want to push that hard with our offensive players and all everyone with their development as we go a couple weeks of player development, then get into this for real late January. Just the deception, the lookaways, all that. you know, that Hollywood actor inside you. Man, what a deadly skill set that is.
Do you remember, did I ever tell you about, you were definitely on the field when I had like one of my greatest all-time deceptive moves. It was on the roof. It was probably around 8:30 on a Tuesday night in the fall. We were doing 10-man riding. Paul Zidlicky was guarding me. And I was like standing there in the corner, lefty corner. And I like look over and I'm like, oh my God, those girls are so hot. And he turns around to look and I take off up the field, get open, catch it, laughing my head off the whole time while Dom, who rarely yelled, is like, Zid, criminy.
I knew that I could throw you a ball if I was in trouble clearing it. You know, Jamie Monroe, number three, you could lob him a ball because if his defenseman wasn't looking at the ball carrier, but was looking at his man, Jamie, you could wait until the ball was within about 1 second of landing in your stick. You could just stand there disinterested, like nothing is going on this side of the field. And then bam, catch the ball.
Do you remember me trying that when you threw one to me? And Tim Sudan definitely knew that I wasn't going to be catching this ball. That it was coming. Do you remember that one? I got blown up right in front of the hill.
I think. Speaking of Dom,
it took a bounce though. It took a bounce. That was the problem. Soft field.
Speaking of Dom rarely yelling, that was one of the few times Dom yelled at me during because we were at UMass. I think we were already down by 4 or 5 goals. That bad pass by me was not helping any. Things didn't get better, but from there either.
Well, LT, man, I love talking lacrosse with you. I'll follow up along the way here, and we'll catch up on stuff. But good luck.
So great.
Tell everybody to say what's up, and Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Crush 2024.